Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Olympic silver medalist, the winner of New York City Marathon, and the winner of the 2014 Boston Marathon. Please give it up for Mr. Matt Kowalski. Yeah!
I just want to say thank you, everybody.
You guys know this is also Meb's birthday, by the way. How about that?
And Bob's birthday, we're twins.
We are twins, yes. We are twins, yeah.
We were separated at birth.
Exactly. We were separated at birth. I was in Chicago and he was in Eritrea. I got the better side of that bargain. Talk.
I'm going to tell you all about how Eritrea was. You know, I didn't have electricity or running water. I got to do a lot of chores, but I guess you just have to deal with the cold, I think.
Exactly. So talk a little bit about Eritrea. Talk about growing up back then.
Well, for most of you don't know, I was born in Eritrea in the middle of a war that lasted for 31 years against Ethiopia. And basically, you didn't know what the next day brings. It was just, the soldiers were surrounded at night. So if you look like 12 years old and you could be able to hold a gun, you're going to be gone. And if you try to run, they're not scared of shooting at you. So I remember my brothers, I have two older brothers, they were hiding in the tree in the yard where there's cactus and thorn and things like that. So because as you hear word spreads, you tell, hey, the soldiers are here. So that before they get to your house, you're trying to find a hiding place. And you know, my dad has to make a decision eventually as the war got intense to escape to Sudan. You know, we're not too far away from Peñasquitos Canyon. Just imagine in the wilderness like that, you're just going to go that way for 225 miles. That might be Nevada or something, but or Arizona. So that's all you have. And then, you know, it was tough because my mom, you know, and dad have five kids, one on the way, and my mom have to encourage him to go because otherwise he's going to get prison or killed. So what good is he in that way? So it's just some take the moment to go, and he did, and unfortunately he made it, and he escaped from Eritrea.
He escaped from Eritrea, and usually people escape from the Sudan, not to the Sudan. So he gets through the Sudan and eventually gets to Italy?
Correct.
And then brings the family over there?
Yeah, I mean, he got two different jobs and in Sudan, and you know, and then he made it. His girlfriend helped him escape from Sudan to Italy, and then when he got to Italy, they both work hard, and they work on the same boss, but they were so workaholic that, you know, my dad is tenacious and does everything right, and from that he got acquainted with his bosses, and he said, you know, can you lend me some money? And he says, how much do you need? That conversation happened on Friday. He says, well, I need about 10,000 lire, 1986, which is about $6,000. And is that to save one person or the whole family? He says, that's to save the whole family with the money that we have saved. And he said, come back Wednesday. And he gave him an envelope in cash, 10,000 lire. And he said, it's not a loan, it's a gift. And that's how we got saved.
That got the family to Italy.
And, you know, my dad, all he wanted was to spend time with us. And the only way I never had a dialogue with him for 5 to 10 years old. And he sent us shoes, he sent us clothes, but all he could do that is through the Italian kids. In Eritrea, we barely had enough food to eat.
Right.
In Italy, you get three courses and gelato at the end. So you grow bigger and you get bigger and that way. So, but he has to say, how old is your son? He'll say, you know, 7. Oh, I got a 7-year-old. And he would look at the tag and try to buy that. That's our only way. And when he got connected, I was the first one. It was in Athens. I was the first one to run through the airport. And then he goes, Marhawi. And
so he thought you were your younger brother.
Yeah,
you
4 years
small.
Younger. that's how disconnected he was with age. And he says, no, it's my Brahton. He's like, he just started crying just because, like, wait a minute. I expect you to be this big and you are this small. And you guys got help. How about the people that don't get help? So my mom never traveled in her life before. First time in a plane for all of us. And she's like, don't cry about sizes and heights. Just make sure everybody's here because, you know, she has to deal with six kids not knowing the language the first time on the plane. Right. And so, but she's really, you know, she's an amazing, amazing individual. She was the father and the mother when we were in Eritrea, you know, cultivating everything from having somebody help her plant the seed, you know, with the oxen. And, you know, you have to, it's not like you have a tractor you have to do with, you know, with oxen. And, you know, you have to harvest it and save for some. And she has to make many, many miles to her grandfather, her father's, our grandfather, village, which is, I think it was about, I think I want to say 90 kilometers or so, by foot, you know, and, you know, making things happen. Sometimes there's not enough hay, so where my dad's village was, and they have to take the oxen back there, and I was too young to help. My two older brother did help her with that, and if we ever get on the way back, they got him a ride on the bus there. They were lucky otherwise. Just walking, you know, for you guys, all of you can relate to that in terms of athletic. We do it as a hobby, but imagine to do that as a survival.
So, and there were times when you were near Eritrea where, in terms of dinner, dinner might be just a bowl with a little dirt with a little water on it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a, you know, you really barely, you know, I remember, you know, we have to stay fino. Fino was something like, you know, the almost like French bread. So you get flowers as my mom was doing chores as, you know, for the government. What she got paid in return was flowers and grain. And I remember just, you know, says USA aid, I think it said on the boxes. And we used to wait in line to get those. And sometimes you go so hungry that, you know, your mind is saying you need some minerals. I remember digging and digging and digging in the dirt. And as soon as it get moist, I have nothing else but to eat it, and that's how I, you know, part
that's
of
how you survive.
And the soldiers did that a lot. It's a survival instinct in many ways. So that's how my childhood was.
What do you remember about
not tiramisu like today or cheesecake
today. For your birthday? Yeah. What do you remember about coming to the U.S.? Did you speak any English at all when you first came here? You were what, 12 years old?
You know, we learned Italian in 6 months when we were there. When you're a kid, you adapt very quickly. And I remember I went and visited my teacher, which I'm still in touch with, from Italy after London Olympics. I took my wife. My wife already had met her, but I took my kids to meet her. And she says, you were very intelligent because even though you didn't speak the language, you got into the blackboard and solved the math problem. And I knew then that you were intelligent, and you know, but English was tough, Italian was tough, and then when we came here, culture shock, you know, no finance background, or we grew up on welfare, and then we came to the United States with them. The reason San Diego was my sister Ruth was living here, and that she sponsored us to come, and the Red Cross helped us to come here, and eventually my dad has to pay some of to the Red Cross, but didn't speak the language, knew everything, the language, the culture, and I mean, in Italy, I was the only African there, you know, in the middle of the all Italian classes, and now we have very diverse group in the U.S.
Right.
background, and it was like America. You don't know anything about America, just know how nice it is, and you hear about it, but you know how diverse it is, and basically, didn't speak the language. I was supposed to be in seventh grade, but they put me in sixth grade, so I could use that 1 year, a transition year. But my other brother was seventh grade. They were in the same grade when Eritrea, and the other one was placed in ninth grade. So imagine yourself not knowing the language and placed in ninth grade. But my parents woke us up about 4:30 in the morning to learn English, go to the dictionary, and work hard. And my brother got the most outstanding student, the one that was in ninth grade, and they gave him a trophy about this big, and that's how it gave us hope, and that through hard work anything can be achieved, and that's how, you know, we made it in the U.S.
So you're in Morley Field, and you're noticing these people who are running, and in where you're from, you run after a ball. You run after a soccer ball, and these people were running, and there was no ball involved, and you're wondering, what the heck? What are these people doing?
Yeah, we came here on October 21st, 1987. We moved to Arizona Street, and which is like literally a half mile or so. We used to dribble the soccer, and some people say, you know, football. We're like,
yes.
Yes, and you think football, coming from Italy, thinking about soccer. But they brought the American football. We're like, what do you do with that? So it's kind of like different. So they made fun of us, and you know, football here is the, you know, they show it up on the brown ball, and then when we go to Molly Field, we dribble the soccer on the sidewalk and head there, and basically, you know, we play soccer. That's what my dad won, and then all of a sudden we see people running, and we're like, what are they chasing? These are crazy people. And that's how, I think at that time it was probably, you know, first week of December probably, or I think it was the Foot Locker. At the time was Kinney Championship, and that's how I got introduced to run, and I became one of the crazy people.
You became one of the crazy people. So at school, they had a mile run, right? And you ran the mile because you wanted to, you know, you wanted to achieve as a PE student.
You know, through everything, you know, Karen was my teacher here, Karen Lant, and Memorial, and then Dick Lord was my PE teacher, and he said to the students like this, hey, if you guys work hard and push yourself, you're going to get, as long as you put the effort, you're going to get A or B, or if you mess around or goof around, you're going to get D or F. Well, it wasn't around the fall, around the track either. It was just like, if you guys are next to the zoo ever, just check it out. Then the junior high next to it. You started the tennis court, go in the middle of the softball field, and then go to the middle of the campus, around the ramp, and then around the softball field, and then finish in the middle of the campus. And to do that, to get an A, or to get the t-shirt, you need to run, you know, to get 6 minutes and 15 seconds for the mile, you know. And I ran hard. I don't want to disappoint my parents. I don't want to disappoint the teacher. So I always wanted to get an A. That's what parents wanted. And I ran hard, and then the coach looked at his watch, and it said, 5 minutes and 20 seconds. I got my A. I got my t-shirt. And he says, you're going to go to the Olympics. But it's 1988, actually.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be Olympic year. We didn't know. We didn't have TV. We didn't watch that. Or we didn't know it was an Olympic year. And, you know, I don't know what the Olympics were. So I have to go ask my dad one day and so what the Olympics are, and fortunately he told me, and you know, I immediately didn't register, but eventually, obviously, I became an Olympian. But that's how my running started, and consistency has been one of my God-given talent. And I ran 5:20, 5:17, 5:15, 5:13, and 5:10 by the end of the year.
Yeah.
So it was just small progress, and you know, it was. I guess I became the fastest seventh grader, so that's how I made friends.
And then through high school, obviously you're winning some CIF, you're doing really, really well. This coach from UCLA comes down named Coach Bob Larson, who had a great history here in San Diego at at Grossmont College, and then moving on to UCLA and the Hamul Toads. When you first met him, do you have a sense of what type of coach he was going to be?
I have no idea what kind of coach Larson would be. All I know is that I want to go to UCLA because so much, you know, television on basketball and football was emphasis, and then also the academic. I wanted to go there was always on TV, mm-hmm. and that's how I knew UCLA. But people did tell me that if you go to UCLA under Bob Larson, that he will take care of you and put under his wings. And that's all I knew. And honestly, I mean, I just wanted to be the best in the league, maybe best in my high school first and the best in the league, and then CIF, and then hopefully by my end of my junior, senior year, maybe be a state champion. But it was just a small increments at a time, small progress at a time. And, you know, Coach Larson was one of the best things that happened to me. And he came and recruited me with Eric Peterson, and you know, he said he practiced the whole drive from L.A. to San Diego, how to pronounce my last name.
Yes.
And he didn't get it right away. But, you know, and it was fun. And then eventually I ended up going to UCLA. And then two brothers and sisters below me followed me to UCLA and became doctor and then also a law degree from UCLA, both undergrads.
What Coach Larson says is when he was going to offer Meb a partial scholarship, But when he met Meb's family, and was that 10 kids at that time? Probably close, right? Yeah.
It was nine.
Nine. That's why he gave the full scholarship, because of the family. He says, yeah, Meb got part of it, but the family got the rest.
Right? That, yeah, that's his claim of fame, and I'm thankful that he did give me a full scholarship. Otherwise, yeah, I would have been somewhere else.
So when you're running at UCLA, what did you think was going to be your best distance?
Oh, I mean, going to UCLA, I thought I'd be a miler.
Yes.
I was a miler. I ran 405 in high school, and then 852 as my senior year. And I still think, you know, I moved too fast to the 10K and 5K. In fact, as a freshman, I qualified for NCAA titles. I finished fifth. And then right after I qualified at Mount SAC, we went to Penn Relays. I did my first 10K as a freshman because I already qualified for the 5K. He wanted me to qualify for the 10K, and it was miserable. It was the worst thing ever.
That's a long way.
It's a long way. I think I was getting sick in the process on the day of the race, and I'm looking to the right. Every time you go to a lap, I'm like, please tell me to drop out. Please tell me to drop out. I didn't. I ran slower than I did across country or on the hills, but it was, you know, it was tough. It was a tough 10K debut.
In college, you won four NCAA championships, 5,000, 10,000 cross country. When did the marathon, I mean, out of college, did you think of yourself that, hey, I'm going to be a professional runner out of college?
Two people told me that I'm going to be a great marathoner. Ron Tabb, who was a local coach who helped me on the side when I was in high school, and then Mike Anderson, one of my teammates, who was more 300-meter hurdles, but yeah, he did cross-country just to be conditioned. His dad always said, you're going to be a beautiful marathoner. I'm like, how far is that anyways? but eventually I learned it was 26.2, but I think it was difficult to make that transition because I still wanted the 10K, but I said, let's see what, you know, 2002 is when I did my first marathon. That was, you know, the world championship out on odd years. The Olympics are not in another 2 years, so I decided to give it a shot, what everybody had been talking about, the marathon, and I was ready. I'm like, did the work, and you know, when you condition yourself, it feels good for 16, 17, 18 miles. And then after that, there's something called imaginary wall. And I decided Alberto Salazar won it when he was in college. This is New York City Marathon. And I'm like, I think I could do it. I've been out of college for a few years. I think I could do it. And took the lead at 16 to 18. And I put water on my head. It was 38 degrees. That water had been sitting there for 3-5 hours, so it's probably frozen. and then I threw my beanie away, my gloves away. I'm just kind of getting serious, and I was wearing very, very light shoes that use in the track, like
racing
instead of
flat.
Wearing spikes. Yeah, instead of wearing spikes, if you have Achilles, you wear those. I'm like, lighter, better. I didn't know any better. Lighter and better shoes is what I went with, and then instead of doing nice rhythm, I start stomping the ground, and I was fourth place. I thought best scenario I could win it, and then maybe worst scenario finish fourth. I got slower and slower. I finished ninth. I ran 2:12:35, which was good, but the winning time was 2:08:04 or something. So they put over 4 minutes on me in the last 4 or 5 miles. And I said same thing with the 10K. I said never want to do this ever again. But coach did say, I heard this before, so just give it time. And my mom was there, watched me. My parents were there, watched me. And my dad tried to give me a massage and stuff. And then my mom was like, 5K, 10K is okay. No more marathons for you. I was in pain. Moms know when you're in pain. But you know, anyways, it worked out. And then I went back to Eritrea for the first time in 17 years. And I couldn't complain because I saw the way my cousins, my relative was living. It put it in perspective.
Yeah.
And then I said, you know what? I was in temporary discomfort. I wasn't not really in pain. And they said, coach, I want to do Boston. He's like, whoa, what got into you? And I tell him why. And he says, well, we'll do New York, Chicago just to be a faster course because I missed my first marathon. I missed by 35 seconds for the A standard of the Olympic Games. So you have to run sub 2:12. I ran 2:12:35. You know, as an elite athlete, when you make a race, you have to show fitness, and I missed it by 35 seconds to get my full payment. So it was painful financially, emotionally, and physically, but eventually it turned out for the best.
It did. So jumping ahead to 2004 in Athens, right? At that point, you've been training with Coach Larson and Coach Vigil up at Mammoth. American distance running throughout the 90s really went backwards. We only had, in the year 2000, we only had one American man and woman qualify for the Olympics in the marathon. We had had, by 1980, we had 280, 290 guys running sub-220 for the marathon. By 2000, we had 56. It had gone totally backwards. And the program that Coach Larson with Meb and Ryan Hall and Josh Cox and Coach Vigil created up at Mammoth, training up at altitude, trying to turn around what was happening with American distance running. And by 2004, with Meb and Dina, the thought was that they were ready to take on the rest of the world. So going into that race, I think you had the 39th fastest PR in the field, right? And but take us through that race, because that turned out to be a classic race and really an important milestone in your career.
It was, I guess, 14 years ago yesterday that I made a name for myself. At the 2001, I got the American record in the 10K.
And right.
By that, I trained 3 weeks at altitude. And then the rest is history, you know. But before that, even in 2000, you have to make a realistic goal. In 2000, my dad told me, you're going to win this race. I'm like, Dad, I'm not going to win this race. It's the Olympic Games, you know.
Yes.
They already run 26:30 and haven't broke 28 minutes yet. So that's a minute and a half. And I hope I didn't get lapped. And that's what I told them. But before I left the stadium, I finished 12th in the Olympics. Before I left the stadium, I really wanted to do something special for the United States to bring a medal. And when I made that thought, I thought it was going to be in the 10K versus the marathon.
Right.
But in 2004, I had the chance to run I won the trials. I was set national and a championship record in the 10K, and I was runner-up in the trials to Culpeper in the marathon. But Coach Larson and I discussed why we should do the marathon, because you know, the hills, the humidity, and you know the course itself will make everybody equalize. And going to that race, it was a tough decision. You want the 6 miles, 6.2 or 26.2, 2 weeks vacation, the first event, or to the closing ceremony. So, and then to be more chances of medaling, my time was in the 10K. It was a 27:13 versus in the 39 fastest. But we basically just decided to go with the marathon, because to be in Greece, where the Olympics started, to be the original course of the marathon, from Marathona to Athens, and to be hot and hilly, is going to equalize everybody. You know, the world record at the time was 2:04:55. So the only way for me to challenge him is if I get a 1 mile head start to Paul Turga, but I know that's not going to happen. But, you know, we just really focus. You know, everybody, Dina and I, Coach Jovijo and Coach Larson, they went the course, they saw the course, and we done the best we can to prepare. And I saw that course, I said, Coach, I don't know what I'm going to feel like on mile 20, but this is not a hill. So we knew we were ready, and the race starts slow, make progress. Up 15K, I give him thumbs up, and, you know, about 5 miles to go or 6 miles to go, I know I was going to be a medalist. And then De Lima got attacked. I don't know if you guys saw some of you guys. That,
right.
You know, it was I didn't see it happen, but it was a tough day. And then eventually, with about 5K to go, Stefano Bollini, you know, before that, I said, you know, my little Italian that I speak, he's just as big. I tell him, andiamo uno a due, which means let's go get one and two. And he looked at me, he's like, who's this guy, African-American, speaking Italian? I made one mistake. That's when I should have took off.
Yes.
But I didn't, and he eventually got, and he got the gold, and then eventually I got silver. But it's a wonderful thing, because as you guys are in triathlon, you know, you don't really wait until the last 100 meters to see if you won or if you medaled or you finished. You know, you get to see unfold how it was coming out. For me, it was a memory lane almost, back to seventh grade, to high school, college, and coming to the United States, all those like coming back to my head is like, I'm going to do what I said I was going to do to bring our country a medal. And with 1 mile to go, I threw my hat. I was trying to catch him, but we were running. He was like 4:28. I was running 4:33, you know, at the end of the race. You know what? You got to give him a good handshake to him for be able to pull it off. And, you know, Italian won the gold. I was silver, and then Brazilian guy who got attacked. got the bronze medal. So Athens was a special moment because that's where I met my dad after 5 years of separation. So he met us in Athens. So for those reasons, it was a great significance.
Well, and the significance for America was Dina took the bronze, Meb took the silver, and America was back. And flashing ahead, all of a sudden, Americans are a factor on a world scene with Ryan Hall and with Meb and with Dina. So as we move forward into 2008, obviously the thought is you're going to make another Olympic team and go win an Olympic medal. But you had some injury issues and in the trials didn't make the team. And more importantly, the next morning when the trials were in New York that year, and the next morning when the race was happening, the regular New York City Marathon, for Meb to watch the race, you basically had to crawl on the ground in your hotel room to crawl on the carpet to get to the window because you couldn't stand.
You're right, Bob. I mean, I personally thought I was going to go to Beijing and win a gold medal.
Right, yeah.
The reason is not to be, high achiever or whatnot, but Athens was my fourth marathon. So you think with the experience,
yeah,
by getting second in New York, by finishing third in New York, third in Boston, I thought, I think I can do it. And I was favored to win the trials and go, but it didn't happen. And it was devastating both, more so because my good friend Ryan Shea, who was on the bus to the starting line, eventually had cardiac arrest and passed away. And
During the
race. So it does put life in perspective, not going to the Olympic or losing your life. So It was devastating, and I remember I just sent Howie, my brother, to say, go look for Alicia Shea, his wife, we're in the same hotel to check up on her, and I could not go because I was like literally crawling, like 10-month-old baby. Just if I want to go to where the TV is, I would have to crawl and then use the wall and then go like this side by side, 1 foot on the step aside all the way. And, I remember my wife just told me, this is painful. I can't see you do this. And you have your UCLA degree. I got my South Florida degree. We can make other things in life and then see you in pain. I said, well, if God has a plan, let it be. I'm happy with the silver medal. Let's make it, let's pray about it. And I'm happy with the American record or championship that I had.
Sure.
But eventually we prayed about it and I did a lot of therapy, a year and a half therapy, and then came back. But yeah, I mean, everything, whether it was go to see the race or whether it's to go to the restroom or to go to my bag, I have to crawl. I could not stand up with my waist because I had, what I didn't know at the time was the course was so tough that people were saying up, down, it's going to beat you up. It's going to be 2:15 winning time. And Ryan Hall ran 2:09 or something. And, people were talking excuses that how the course was. But 10 weeks later, it's 10 weeks later that I did the MRI and the doctor goes, good news and bad news. The good news is you don't need a cortisone shot for my glutes medius or piriformis syndrome, and then the good news is that your bones are failing, and you had a pelvic stress fracture 10 weeks ago.
Oh my God!
So
yeah,
yeah. If you felt something, you can know. But I think I overcompensated and just pounding, and I thought I just kept going because I was supposed to win, and then I think I could win. Then when Ryan took away, I'm like, maybe I'm going to use him to get second place. And then after that, I'm like, I could be third. And then after that, I'm like, just like 2004, maybe somebody will do the 10K. I could be an alternate. So fourth place. And then after that, it's like, maybe two guys will do, Dathan and Ryan will do the 10K, and then I'm going to go as a second alternate or whatever. So I was trying to make talking myself into it, and sometimes you go over the barrier, and you hurt yourself more than you help.
So you don't know if your career is over at that point, right?
Yeah. No, at that point it was, that December, I remember talking to my family, brothers and sisters. I said, I'm going to need you more than ever. I said, I'm probably going to have to make that transition to retiring or just move on. And, I saw 50 doctors. I spent a lot of hours in physical therapy. And
ran in the pool a little bit?
I ran at the plunge. I was at the pool for 8-9 weeks, every single day, whether I'm doing, I start smelling like chlorine after that, stuff. I know you guys are swimming, you go in the ocean, but I go in the pool. But it was a difficult time, and reduction clauses happening left and right from Nike, and
yes,
and then I was ready to have my second daughter, and family's expanding and your payment's going down.
Right.
It's not a
fun moment. Then the following year, 2009, you win the New York City Marathon, and no American had won that since the early 80s. Winning that race basically rejuvenated your career at that point.
Well, most definitely. I think when we prayed with my wife and I tell her that my Olympics will be New York City Marathon, I thought it would be in 2008 instead of 2009, but the therapy took longer. And I tried to rush to get to the 10K, try to make the team so I didn't get reduced.
Yes.
So I did more damage in that way, but it has that peace of mind, let the body heal. But 2009, that was my Olympics personally, just because as you talked about Dina and Coach Vigil, Bob Larson, and myself, our t-shirt said, taking on the world, running USA, taking on the world. And that day I felt like I was taking on the world because, you know, I got second place, third place, and finally I'm wearing the USA jersey and we're taking on the world. I start pointing at it, and it was for that personal gratification wise, that was it for me.
Exactly.
Because I couldn't walk. If somebody told you do all the therapy that you do this, do that, so you can have, you're gonna win, that would be easy to do, but there's no guarantees. You just gotta do it because you want to, because you want to achieve great things, and for me that was the amazing time for turnaround for my rejuvenation.
Right. And so heading in the 2012 London, you win the Olympic trials for the London Games, and you go to London and have a great race there, get fourth, right? And you were way back. You ran your way through the field and got fourth, right? And again, one of the older guys in the race. And so people are already talking about you as the grizzled veteran, the older guy. But you're sort of changing perceptions about what someone can do as an older marathoner.
You know, I just watched before the Boston this year, I just watched some of the video that I did at Mammoth Lakes, and I'm cooling down for after my tempo run and getting ready for the London Olympics. And I tell them, yeah, this is going to be my last Olympics. 50 family friends are coming to just saying goodbyes and whatnot. And then, you know, the race was tough because the cobblestones, I had a side egg, I got the wrong fluid, and I had only about 5 weeks of training. So, but, you know, I was going to throw, you know, people usually often ask me, do you enjoy the scenery? And I'm usually, no. I'm thinking about competition. I'm trying to see if I can, you know, be able to win, or what the other competitors are doing, breathing or making a move. But that day did cross my mind to stop and enjoy the view. And I said, this would be a cathedral. This would be a good place to stop. I got New York City's lined up already. I got already silver medal. But and then I realized what I said at the press conference after making the team. We're sending our best team. I hope we can represent the United States the best we can. And I just said, my daughters are watching at the finish line, and family and friends. I said, especially for my girls, if I'm going to tell them to do their best every time, if I stop right now, they're going to ask me, was that your best? And that's not absolutely not my best unless I'm injured. And then also, we were in the USA, and I just said, you know what? I don't care where I finish. I'm just going to go to that finish line. So your mind, is no matter how many people pass you, you just keep going, keep grinding. And eventually, I just said, okay, God, get me to the second group. And then I got second group. God, help me one person. And then all of a sudden, I'm in like top 10 or something. Then Coach Larson points out six fingers. But I was right next to this Japanese guy. And I'm like, he didn't clarify if I was in sixth place or the guy I can see next to me, sixth place. And then I see down the 2 miles to go, I see like literally like 150 meters or so, I see this green jersey. All you can see is a green jersey. I'm like, I can see probably that guy hit the wall. So if he's in fourth place, this Japanese guy's in fifth place, I'm in sixth place. I know I'm thinking I can outkick this guy here. But if I finish fifth, for whatever reason down the road, if somebody get busted with drugs, that guy with the green jersey is going to move to third place and become a bronze medal. So I'm like, I'm going to catch him. And I have a picture of us. One American was there at 1K to go, man, 5 seconds, you can catch that guy. And I love hearing the crowd. I'm like, I got you. I kind of like, I got you. And then 500 meters to go, there's a picture of us, me passing him, and then the 500-meter sign, and then him. But as many other marathons, it was a small finish line. It didn't have like the Boston or the New York or Chicago or other races. I'm like, where's the finish line? Where's the finish line? And then I see the United States flag. I'm like, should I grab it? Should I not? Should I grab it? Should I not? I grabbed it, and then I'm like, I wanted to run with both hands up, but I'm like, this guy's trying to kick and try to catch me again. So I'm like, I tucked it in, just kept running, and I see a little white line there. I'm like, I think that's the finish line. And and I raised both my hands like this with the United States. Sometimes it's not where you finish, but getting the best out of yourself. And from 21st, thinking about dropping out, I end up getting fourth place, which I feel very proud about.
And you never know. Yeah, exactly. In 2013, you were in Boston, but you were a spectator, just like a lot of other folks. And just being a spectator and knowing that what happened to some of the other spectators could have happened to you and your family, mm-hmm. How important was it for you to come back to Boston and represent the U.S. in 2014?
In 2014, it was very important, but in 2013, and I was to start watching the race on the hotel, and people want to get their food, they want to talk, they confront me, I can't watch the race. Because usually I don't get to enjoy races because I'm racing, and then after that I'm into media or drug testing. In fact, my friend Rob Hill is here, who was with me at the Boston and Marathon 2013, and I was telling them how beautiful the sport was, how, in fact, I was taking notes on my phone what the sports provides, the spirit of the marathon. And I tell them, take notes because I can't remember everything that is happening. And we sat there for 4 hours. It was getting windy and cold. From the sun, it gets shady, and then I moved to the sun. It gets shady, to say sun, and then he gave me his jacket. We were just trying to stay there as long as possible. At one point, I tell him, you know what, we should go over where the flags are and where the condors were. I said, let's go crash the party because, I mean, it would be nice to be there inside, be warm, and plus, all I'm going to ask him is probably for hot tea anyways. You know, it would be nice, but then I was like, I look at my clock, we have to go to an appointment. Let's stay be on this side right now so we can go to the hotel, and that's why we didn't go, but we thought about going over there, and obviously when we left, we're 300 meters or so is when we heard the bomb happened, and it's like, how can it be? I left Howie, my brother, there. We left so many people there. In fact, at one point, the shoot was getting so busy. There's two shoots in Boston, and they closed one of them, and I tell them, I see people trying to cross at any clock, trying to beat the clock, whatever, it's 4 hours or 3 hours or 2 hours and 45 minutes, and it was getting congested. I tell the volunteer, you guys need to open the other shoot because people are sprinting, and it's getting congested, and obviously, Bonnie Ford asked me, am I going to come back in 2014? I said, I have to be back. It's the only thing I could do. And I hope to be healthy to compete, but if not, I have to be here to support them. And basically, I train. You know, you see those shirts, you know, Boston Strong or Boston Marathon, and constant reminder for 365 or more to see what can I do, what can I do, something positive. And every time I saw those hats or shirts, I always think, I got to do it. And obviously training gone well. I had a little hiccup with the hamstring in New York. And, you know, come race day, I avoided, you know, because the last 5-6 weeks out is when I got injured a little bit. And I've been avoiding hills. And, you know, Boston is a hilly course. You should do more hills. But, you know, I did avoid it and Mammoth and do the same loop many times just to avoid the hills. And come race day on April 21st. And I tell Coach Bob Larson that who's my mentor now, I said, don't worry. I'm not going to take the lead or do anything until the last 3 miles. As you guys know what happened.
You took the lead in about 10 feet into the race.
I went right away because I don't like to get tripped. I have to get out of the way early, and then all of a sudden settle in, and then 5 miles into it, I can sense the Ethiopians trying to slow it down, and then I just said, you know what? Again, with 3 goals, to win, podium, or run a personal best. If I'm going to do that, I'm going to do it from the front. And, you know, Boston Strong slogan, I'm going to give them my best. And then at 8 miles was two of us, Joseph Boyd and myself, as you saw in the video. And then eventually, I'm like, I don't know what they're thinking, but we're in the zone sometimes. I don't remember going through the halfway point. I don't remember that. This year I saw it was a big 13.1 miles big, but last year I don't remember any of it going through that. And about 15 miles, he kind of clipped me a little bit, not by accident, just by mental note. He's getting tired, he's getting fatigued. do assessments, you know. And then I just said, 16 mile, I know the hills are coming. I want to be by myself, one hill at a time, one step at a time. Use the press track to kind of pull you away. So remember that 520 that I ran in seventh grade? All out, that just became 4:30, a mile 16 with 10 miles to go. I was hurting pretty bad, but I said, this is for our country. Just keep digging, and I, you know, it's point-to-point course, so it's hard to see who's chasing you, but all I could think was, make them hurt. If you get caught, you're going to make them hurt, make them earn it, and about 18, 19 miles, people are getting excited, American in the front, they're chanting, USA, USA. I got into it, I'm like, USA, USA, and it goes, you know, but I'm like, focus, focus, you got a race, you could do that at the end, and then about 21, 22, I got cramped my left side. At 23, I see a person behind me. And when I do a lot of visualization in my training, and I said, it came down to Boylston with two people. I thought it was an Ethiopian guy, but I couldn't tell who was behind because just orange shirt. And I'm like, what should I do? Slow down, save it for Boylston. But as a competitor, as you guys know, if somebody gets next to you, they got the mental edge. So I'm like, that's a stupid plan. Don't take that one.
You're having this discussion with yourself.
I'm having a discussion with myself.
That's nice.
And I just said, well, maintain the lead or expand the lead, and that's what I did. And then at 24, I was digging so deep that bad stuff started happening, almost throwing up. So, but you got to, thank God I was wearing glasses because I kept my head up.
You don't want them to see that.
No, because that's a sign of weakness. And as soon as you do something, they're gonna see what's happening to you. So just kept digging. And at 25, it gone from a minute 15 second lead to 5 second. But I did a good thing. I did, in 2002, when it was hot and tough day in Boston, I was a grand marshal. A friend of mine who, like Karen, ran for my foundation, he told me, if you're here, can you pace me the last mile? I said, sure, I'll do it if I'm here. And I happened to meet that day. In 2012, I paced the guy. He was trying to break 6 hours for the marathon, because it got so hot, and you know, he ended up running, David Kahn, he ended up running 6:42. But I met him there, walked, jogged, every turn. So it came in handy in 2014 because
I knew every inch of it.
And so doing good things can happen, good things to you later on. So basically, with 1K to go, there was a sign. The crowd was amazing. The spirit of the victims, I really felt it, because I had their names on my bib, their names. So I just kept digging and trying to expand the gap. And then over the pass, they said 1K to go. We Americans usually go by miles. How far is that? 2 miles, 3 miles. But when you're talking to Ethiopians and Kenyans, they go by kilometers. So I'm like, darn, this is an advantage to him. He's going to probably think, 3 minutes of pain, 3 minutes of pain. I'm like, he's going to try to catch me. So just dig deep, 3 minute pain for you as well. Just keep going. And then making right on Hereford. The only turn, I sprinted as hard as I can to the finish line because he can't see me. Not to the finish line, but to the next street. By the time he sees me to that turn, make the gap bigger, and he was going to have the mental defeat. Just say, make him say what happened, and then going to Boston, I just crossed myself. I said, thank you, Lord, for giving me this opportunity to lead the 36,000 people. I always wanted to do something positive on Boston, and it gave me great pride to be able to chant USA, USA on Boston Street to change what was catastrophic moment and horrific moment for all of us with the bombing to something. Everybody, when they feature in MEB or USA, and it gave me great pride to be the first American in 31 years to pull the victory.
Yeah. .208 .37 PR, and wins by 11 seconds. And if we talk about the greatest marathons in American history, obviously Frank Shorter, 1972, helped put marathoning on a map. Joan Benoit, the first woman, won the first Olympic marathon for women, 1984. But more importantly than that was Meb's win last year at the 2014 Boston Marathon, the greatest marathon victory for American of all time. How about a round of applause for that? So all of a sudden, it's one thing running media and things like that. Now, all of a sudden, you're an A-list guy. You're hanging with Big Poppy. You're at the Red Sox games. Obama's doing shout-outs on Twitter. How did that win change things in your life compared to other big wins?
You know, it was beyond a race. It was greater than ourselves. It was for our nation, and everybody understood that. And when the Red Sox won and put the trophy at the finish line, I'm like, an American, whether it's Shalane, myself, or Ryan, we need somebody to do it on Patriots Day that day. And to do it, you know, that day on April 21st, it was a big deal. And it's the most meaningful victory of my life. Yeah. And I know New York was more gratifying, like I said, for me, but I know that 520 mile that I ran, it was a signature to say you were on this earth to be a runner, and that solidified for me the Boston Marathon, and by winning the Boston Marathon. And you know, it's a great honor to be recognized for the accomplishment of that, but you know, to get a call from the president, he like you know, my brother and manager, but he's gonna get a call. They tell that from the White House, he's gonna get a call for the next 4 hours or 6 hours, and it will be unknown number. So you can bear in mind that the next day, everybody's trying to get a call to do an interview. And every unknown number, poor guy, is answering it. And he's got to make sure the battery doesn't die. And I was ready to go on Canada Live FaceTime TV, and I was ready to go. And then he tells me, it's like, it's the call. I'm like, what I do. And I gave that the phone to him. He gave me his phone, and I just said, you know, this is the commander of Air Force One. Is this Mepka Flesky? I'm like, yes, it is, sir. And then he's like, well, I'll be transferring to the president now. And then he's like, oh, okay, thank you. And then he like, I'm nervous. I'm like, what do you say? I'm like, hello, Mr. President, how are you? You know, I'm like, I'm good, you know. I said, I just went straight to him, you know, I just wanted to call you, said job well done. I'm like, well, Mr. President, I was at the 2013 Boston. I was there for 4 hours watching it. So I had a lot of personal meaning and significance for this, and I want to do it for the United States. And, you know, he's like, well, you know, you did a great job. I want to just call you and, you know, well done. And I'm like, and he says, we talked about 4 minutes or 4 minutes, almost 45 seconds. And then he goes, we'll be in touch. I'm like, first, when he talked to me, I'm like, this is a gig, because it does, you know, the voice is different on the phone than it is in person or than you hear on TV, right? This is not him. This is a gimmick.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, and he goes, we'll be in touch. I'm like, yeah, right, we'll be in touch. But he lived up to it. He invited my wife and I, and myself and a guest. I took my wife for dinner at the U.S. Africa Leaders Summit, and we got invited. And he goes, you know, and first he goes, you know, they introduce you, but before they introduce me, I come to the door. Oh, here comes the fast guy. Here comes the fast guy. And then, you know, we just, it's like, I used it at the correspondence dinner. Did you know that? I'm like, yeah, I know, Mr. President. I saw him. Do you know what I said? I'm like, yeah, I know what you said. And he's like, I said, and an American won the Boston Marathon because a Kenyan has been a president for 6 years. And you know, it was pretty funny. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you know. It's. And he goes, and First Lady Michelle is saying, I thought I was talking to the person behind me. She's like, you're going to be in our table or something. I'm like, I'm not going to be in their table. And then I'm like, table 25. We were searching for table 25. And then there were some people sitting there. And it's like, do you know what table 25 is? They're like, it's right here. We're like right next to the stage, you know? Like, and the Obamas are sitting here. I don't think so. And I looked, and it's like, yeah, President Barack Obama, First Lady. I'm like, and then I look my name. It said Mr. Honorable Keflesky or something. And it's like, oh, cool. And I'm like, he's like 2 seats away from me. Michelle's 1 seat away from me. So it was like, wow. For somebody who grew up without electricity or running water and coming as a refugee to be at the White House is big, but to be at the head of the table, that's even pretty amazing experience.
That's a pretty amazing experience. So, yeah. After that Boston race, how messed up was your foot? I heard something about you had to drain your foot a number of times.
Yeah, yeah. really, 17 miles, I know I was hurting. And then 17 miles was, so I done Boston twice, two other times before that. 2006, I got dropped at, right before the fire station, about 17, 18 miles. And then 2010, I ruptured my quad at that point. I felt it. And then this 2014, I can hear, feel that. This issue has been with me since 2001 on the track. It's been with me in 2007. And then 2011 was the worst of all, where I, unfortunately, I left a breathe right on my, you know, because my new sponsor, I didn't have a pocket. I usually put my chapstick and Vaseline and then breathe right on my pocket, but I didn't have pockets. So I'm like, so I won't forget in the morning. I just put in my shoes. And the breathe right never came off. And then
it was in your shoe while you're running the marathon?
Yes.
Ooh, that's not where it's supposed to be, I don't think.
I went. This is exactly what happened. I'm like, I feel something mile one right after the bridge in New York City Marathon. First thing I did is, it's not on my nose. So I knew that's what was bothering me. But you know, I usually do strides and tough, and you know, the shoes are too lace are too tight or too loose and whatever. But that day I didn't feel anything, and I felt it the whole way. And imagine how hard that plastic is, and it just scratch is doing this for you the whole time, right on the bottom of the feet. And eventually it got infected. I stopped at 25 miles or 22 miles to throw up that year, and I could have stopped and get ready for the trials, but I like to start a project and finish the project. And I finished the race. I ran a personal best, and basically that aggravating like this kind of got really deep, many layers, and then ever since been an issue. To this day, if you look at my foot, it's still a little bit red spot on it, even though it's been since November of 2011.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's, I was hurting at mile 17. I just say, ignore the pain. You're still in the lead. You can win this for the United States. And if you saw the video, if you look closely, my mechanic does get off. I mean, not at the last 300, 400 meter potentially, because I'm getting off the ground quicker, but I overcompensate. And basically afterward, Coach Larson drained it. I drained it. The doctors at Red Sox drained it before the pitch. A doctor in New York drained it. A total of 16 times. I have
16?
16.
Wow.
So I was walking like this, and I have to put Dr. Scholl donuts to be able to, for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. That's what I have to do. So it didn't get affected from that, but it just, you when you're running 9 miles on it, it gets another blister, another blister, another blister, and it becomes more like a wound. And it was terrifying. It was not pretty.
You mentioned throwing up in races, and I know this year you were with the leaders till 22. But this year the throwing up became, I mean, you had to stop, right? 5 times, but you still finished 8th place, even though you stopped 5 times during the race. And I know obviously you want a podium, you want to win, but coming through, getting 8th place with everything that you've been doing, you've basically been an ambassador for the sport of running for this last year, 365 days. And the way you came through the finish, there was a woman pro, the women went off first, and Meb came through, and there was a gal who was in like 15th place or so. Meb grabbed her hand, and you made her day. You guys came through the line together. And that really is what sportsmanship is all about.
You know, this year was different, and I really thought I could have a shot at defending the title. This is the healthiest I've been in last year, and you know, but I can't do it was because I can't do what I did last year, get away with it, because they're not gonna let me go. 2, it was windy, and 3, so I just decided 3rd is just stay with it, be smart, don't be in the lead, and I was just saving my energy. I'll be honest, for the last 2 miles or 1 mile to go, just somebody will make a move before that, and then if not, you need to make a move right then and use the crowd to your advantage to be able to get you to that finish line. And I was saving all my energy. It saw me in the lead a little bit going up the hills. The reason I was doing that is because they were surging, slowing down, surging, slow down, surging, slow down. So on the hills, if I could push it a little bit, I could get them out of their comfort zone, build more lactic acid in their legs. So when it comes to the last mile or 2 miles, I can have a little advantage. That's my way of thinking. Sure. Why I was in the lead. But at 23 miles at the drink, I just, you know, I was, you know, this is an advantage to be number one, the bib number, but there's the disadvantage is you got to be on top of it every water station. You'd be the first one on the table, so you can't be. You have to be alert and take your drink because you can't say, "Oh, the guys are getting the drink. I'm gonna go and get mine. It's too late." So I was trying to do on top of it, and I got my drink. And as I was drinking, I could see them making a move, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm gonna skip quick on my feet." I'm like, "I'm gonna skip the next drink. Just take a couple more, and you throw it away and catch up." And it decided not to go down. It wanted to come back up, and then I'm like, basically, just imagine like you jump in and somebody's pushing you almost. You're trying to land, trying to throw up, and trying to maintain the pace. And it's like in shock at the same time, so I have to stop and throw up, and then everybody just went quiet. Dead silence. We was cheering, and all of a sudden just stood quiet. And then all of a sudden I'm like, I just cleaned myself. And I start running. They're like, "Yeah!" and then I knew I had to go to the finish line somehow, some way. And then I was trying to close the gap too before it got too big and too big of a lead. And then all of a sudden I go 50 meters, 60 meters, and then the same thing happens. It's quiet, then gets loud. And then I'm like, and then I have to stop 5 times in the last 3 miles. Not the last mile, but I felt like this coming, but it didn't stop. But I was trying to catch that girl. But a 1.5 mile, I passed one girl. I said, "Good job, keep going," or whatever. And she tried to tuck in before me, but there was one guy ahead of me. I'm like, "I'm going to catch him. So I would love to run with you, but not today. I'm going to try to catch that guy." and I did that. And then basically, I said, to win, podium, or personal best. And obviously, with the weather, that's not going to happen. But I also, if I can't do those, I'm going to fight for every spot there is. Because you got to take advantage of it. You cannot rerun it again. So basically, come to Boylston, and I was having another tough, almost throwing up, but I'm like, kept going. I see this girl. I mean, it's like literally the finish line is probably where the desk is, at the end of the hall. And then she's like, where the red thing is.
Yep.
And the finish is probably in a little bit, and I'm right here. I'm like, I got to sprint. I got to catch her. And then try to raise her hand, but it was just nick of a time. I barely got up to her, but it was fun to be able to cross the finish line with her. And I don't know who she was. It's Hillary Dion.
Hillary Dion
now.
American.
American and yes. Olympic trial qualifier. And so she's a full-time worker. I gave her a call a few days ago, and I got a chance to talk to her. And, you know.
You made her day.
No, we all make it our day when making the finish line. And I'll be honest, you know, sometimes I'm happy to bring my medal, too.
Yeah, baby.
It's not the winning medal, but sometimes when you can't get it done, I always say run to win doesn't mean getting first place, but getting the best out of yourself. And we all get to that finish line. If I had to stop 5 times and get my way up there, and if I have stopped, I wouldn't have earned this medal and the finish with Hillary.
How about a huge round of applause for Mr. Meb Keflezighi? How about a little standing ovation for our man here? You are the legend, buddy. Thank you so much for taking so much time.